You are listening to KBOO Portland.
During the Republican and Democratic National Conventions, Democracy Now! Is expanding to 2 hours. Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Crew broadcast from Cleveland and Philadelphia and report from the streets to the suites to the convention floor.
Hear it every weekday morning from 7 to 9 a.m., July 18th through the 29th, right here on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 13th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, a 3-day, all-ages music festival, Friday, July 22nd through Sunday, July 24th at Audio Cinema in Portland. 43 artists will be performing over the 3 days, including special high school band sets curated by Friends of Noise. The festival also features a record fair, street fair, food carts, and more. Again, that's the 13th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, a 3-day, all-ages music festival, Friday, July 22nd through Sunday, July 24th at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Radio and the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group bring you the 2016 Willamette River Festival, Sunday, July 31st at Cathedral Park from noon till 7. Celebrate, dance, and reconnect with the wonderful Willamettes. Musical guests include Logger's Daughter and Zydeco Bands, Cascade Crescendo, and the New Iberians. Also, DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. That is July 31st at Cathedral Park. More information at www.willamettriverfestival.org.
And we've got some great information coming down on that. Also, later on in the broadcast, we'll see what's going on in the streets outside the convention in Cleveland. But first, an incredibly important issue, and we want you to deal with it in the context of both campaigns. Joining us to talk about, the crucial issues regarding fracking, climate change, related life and death issues that are being ignored, probably by both campaigns in a way that could be very dangerous. Joining us is Maura Stevens. Maura Stevens is an independent journalist and founding member of the Coalition to Protect New York and FrackBustersNewYork.org. Maura Stevens, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much, Dennis. Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have.
We're going to talk more about this. Again, we're going to be out with you for the next 4 hours. But first, we want to begin with a conversation we had with journalist Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank is well known for his books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? His latest book is really a takedown on the Democratic Party. It's called Listen, Liberal. And we did talk about both the Republican and Democratic parties. Thomas Frank, it's good to see you again.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Now, we're at the Republican convention, not the Democratic one. Are you working on something concerning the Republican convention?
I always am. You know that. So I've written about conservatives for years. This new book about the Democrats is a departure for me. But look, these conventions, as you walk around in the street outside, I mean, there's always hilarious material to write about. Like, for example, on my way over to this building, there was, you know, they've been talking about all the protests. They're worried about all these protesters, and there's this enormous police presence here in Cleveland. I mean, enormous, right? And it's all over the city. Wherever you go in the city, they're out there. They've got like snow plows ready to block off the streets and stuff. So anyhow, but they haven't had anything to, as far as I've seen, they haven't had anything to go into action against. Okay, so
it was a little more rowdy today, I heard. I don't know the exact details.
Rowdy
yet.
Is the right word, but there weren't any. I didn't see any organized protests, but we did see, as we crossed one of the streets leading up to the convention center, a lone street preacher denouncing everybody who passed and like, you're all going to hell. And he was screaming, and there were maybe 20 cops lined up ready to take him on.
Well, as you mentioned, you've written...
kind of awesome, really.
Did they get him?
they were like, move along, you know. It's one street preacher.
Yeah. Now, you have written a lot about Republicans in the past. What's the matter with Kansas?
Yeah, well, you see it here, right?
Well, what do you think about Donald Trump then and what you were writing about with that book, what, 10 years ago or so?
That was 12 years
ago. Was it 12 years ago?
It's everything, I mean, it's all gone so much farther. Just to gloat a little bit.
Yeah.
Were
you right?
The main criticism of that book was that, oh, no way. The white working class is solidly Democratic and will always be.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, you're whistling past the graveyard, my friend. And here we are. I mean, it's, no, things have changed quite a bit since then. That was all about the culture wars back then. And now here we are, basically one depression later. And everything is curdled, is so much worse, you know, so much angrier. By the way, can I tell you another funny thing I saw on the way over here?
Sure.
So this is, and this also gives you some insight into why people like Donald Trump. I saw two T-shirts, not one, but two T-shirts that depicted a cartoon Trump flipping the bird at, you know, the powers that be. In one case, it was like the puppet masters that rule, that make the marionette politicians dance. And then the puppet Donald Trump had a pair of scissors and had cut the wires and was flipping off the puppeteer. Right? I mean, it's kind of a high concept, well, or a medium concept idea anyway. But there's a whole bunch of them. There was more than one T-shirt that involved Trump flipping the bird. Fascinating.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the big
protest mysteries, candidate.
Yeah, but in a kind of an awful way.
Yeah.
And, I mean, one of the big mysteries that I'm trying to understand is why working class people like him so much. I mean, he doesn't, I think, but I think those T-shirts give you the answer. It's all about the style, the language, the anger. I'm sorry, I don't want to criticize Trump because it's like a waste of time, you know, to point out his policy proposals lack substance. You know, his policy proposals don't exist.
Yeah.
He's a ridiculous man.
Are you surprised he's the candidate?
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's everything that's going on this year is crazy. Everything in the Republican side. The Democratic side is, they have, you know, the insiders have managed to reassert control, and they've, you know, no surprises. They put down the threat of Bernie Sanders, such as it was, and they are steaming complacently towards the White House as they think. And, you know, I don't want to say I hope they make it, but I sure hope Trump doesn't. By the way, a good friend of mine who's, I think he's pretty moderate politically, but this is a guy that's never had any problem with choosing one or the other of the two main party candidates, said to me the other day, why can't they both lose?
Right. No, we're the only loser, maybe.
Yeah. No, that's right. The public.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Do you think Trump could win?
Do I think Trump could win? Yes, he can. Think about it this way. He's patterning himself after Nixon 68. What a hell of a person to pattern yourself after. But that's what he's doing.
Sort of the law and order.
Exactly. Yeah. And if the situation continues to slide more towards a 68 style situation in the streets or whatever, yeah, you can see that happening. But that itself is crazy. There's no Vietnam War going on, you know? For example, one of the big themes last night was betrayal at the top, you know, betrayal by Hillary at the top. Classic Republican theme. They've been riding this hobby horse since the 50s. You know, this is the great McCarthy, and Nixon did it too. The idea that the Democratic administration was filled with communists, blah 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 blah, right? But they were talking back then about the Soviet Union, about losing China. Trump is talking about four guys in Benghazi.
Yeah.
You know,
it's all of these kind of replace that dynamic, though.
They're trying to, they want it to,
yeah.
You know, but it's not, come on, it's not the same thing. This is not, there's not a threat of nuclear annihilation, you know. It's not a global contest of serious ideas. This is, you know, this is not that at all. But they want it to be that. They want it to be that so badly. And they're in a fantasy land, these guys.
Thomas Frank, your latest book, Listen Liberal, is a real critique of the Democratic Party. Of course, here we're hearing a critique of the Democratic Party. Compare and contrast your critique of the Democratic Party and then the critique you hear from the Republicans at the convention.
Well, every now and then they say something that's correct. I don't want to...
When are they correct?
When they talk about globalization and trade, and they blame this on Clinton, I think that is, not Hillary, but Bill, I think that's fair. And when they blame it on Obama, that is fair. These people are globalizers at heart, and they really believe in this agenda. And that is also, I think, a big part of Trump's blue-collar appeal, is that, you know, that trade issue. I think that's a fair critique of the Democrats. A lot of the rest of it is just... is so much nonsense. Now, they'll often... The other similarity with Listen Liberal is they'll often use the term elite to describe liberals and Democrats. Fair enough. A lot of Democrats are. But what the Republicans will never acknowledge is that they also are an elite. You have more than one elite in this country. The question is, you have, you know, an elite of business, Trump. You have an elite of status, Hillary Clinton, you know, this great lawyer, great mind, with amazing academic credentials, all this kind of thing. You have these two different elites. Where are you and I going to line up? Which side are we going to choose? And that's all. That's always the question. What's fascinating about the Republican critique of the liberal elite is fatuous and misses the point in all sorts of ways. But what's interesting is it's the only real critique of elites out there. The Democrats don't. Well, they won't use theirs. I mean, they have one, right? A critique of big business, of Wall Street. This is the Democratic heritage.
You don't think they are anymore, even after the campaign of Bernie Sanders?
Sanders was doing it. This is what Sanders was on fire. I don't think Hillary can do it because she's so compromised by her association with Wall Street. Barack Obama can't do it. By the way, did you see something? I just wrote about this today. I just published the essay. Today, Barack Obama was asked recently by Business Week magazine what he wanted to do after his presidency, what industry he might go into. Did you see what he answered?
No.
Venture capital.
Venture capitalism. Did he say anything else, but did he just say venture capitalism?
No, it wasn't. It was a, you know how he speaks in these sort of, you know, long sentences.
Yeah.
And always complete sentences. You got to admire Barack Obama. But he was talking about Silicon Valley and he said that's the industry that he admires the most. That's where he would like to go. We know what he's going to do. If I was him, I'd go to Hawaii and I would relax for a really long time.
One thing we hear about Hillary Clinton here is that they call her the empty pantsuit.
Yeah.
That she'll go whichever way the wind is blowing. Do you think that's accurate?
I think she's changed her views so many times in the course of her life there's some accuracy to that. But yes, but that's just plain politics. Barack Obama said that about her too in 2008. Yeah. So that's the other thing, is a lot of these critiques go back years and years and years.
Do you think she could be pushed, though, from the people and the energy and the campaign that we saw with Bernie Sanders to be a different Clinton? Maybe it would take a Clinton to undo what Clinton did, the first Clinton.
I'm going to bust some knowledge on you. Bill Clinton himself ran in 1996 as the man who would undo his own welfare reform. He did. This was one of his things. He was like, okay, I know I signed that awful bill, but you got to get me reelected so I can change it. He really campaigned on this promise. It's just like at some point you have to say to the Democrats, it's just enough with this. You know, shouldn't have signed it in the first place. You know, it was a bad move.
How did the Democrats get to that point? How do you lay it out in your book, Listen Liberal?
I think a lot of it is, well, I think it's a class, a it's a class. I always, in all of my books, I gravitate back to social class. I'm fascinated by social class issues. And the Democrats undertook a class shift of their party in the late 60s and early 70s. In some ways, they did it deliberately.
At the same time of the Southern strategy
as
from the
same
Republicans?
Time, yeah. These two, both things happened at the roughly the same time. It's fascinating. It was in with the Democrats, it was called the McGovern Commission.
Yeah.
And the people who were on the McGovern Commission, they wrote books, they wrote magazine articles. You can read about it. And they basically said, we don't want to be the party of working people anymore. These people, a lot of them supported the Vietnam War. We don't want to be that. That's not who we are anymore. And there's this other group out there that is so much more enlightened and progressive, and that is white-collar, affluent professionals. And McGovern was the first Democratic campaign to really more or less openly run that way. Although he himself, just to make the record clear, I admire George McGovern. I think he was a great candidate. By today's standards, he would be elected in a, you know, it would be a cakewalk for, yeah, George McGovern if he was the candidate this year. He's so much more, you know, noble and trustworthy than any of these people. But okay, I'm getting off the subject here. But yes, the Democrats deliberately chose to change sociologically who they were. And Bill Clinton was the product of that transformation. It took years to really come into full effect, but Bill Clinton is a product of that. Barack Obama is as well, and Hillary too.
Did you see that? So again, back to the parallels with the Southern strategy. The narrative is that it was white, poor Southerners,
yeah,
who left the Democratic Party because the party adopted a platform for
civil rights. Yeah, yeah.
And that's what that was. Are you, yeah, saying that there
no,
is say, another...
They both happened at the same time. So Nixon, that really
both
happened.
Responsible for
no,
that?
No, Nixon, the Southern strategy really took place. This,
yeah,
is true.
No, I understand that. But, yeah, but not just the Southern strategy.
Right. So they, both things happened at the same time. And this is the era of civil rights in Vietnam. You know, the country was, was changing pretty massively. So it's... It is strange that they both happened at the same time, but not that strange. I mean, you're talking about canny political players, at least in the Republican side. The Democrats always strike me as more idealistic, you know, head in the clouds kind of, you know. Seriously, you know, Age of Aquarius. If you go back and look at the Democratic literature for why they wanted to do this transformation, it was very much this kind of Age of Aquarius stuff, you know. The young generation is so enlightened. They're so wise, you know, they're not materialistic like we are. And you also have to remember this is 71, 72. This is the high watermark of equality in America. I mean, working class people, blue collar workers lived in the suburbs and had two cars and a motorboat that they would go out on the weekends and drive around on the lake in their motorboat. You know, the issues that are tearing us apart today weren't even on the radar screen then. You know, we were a prosperous nation. I mean, none of the shocks, none of the economic shocks had even happened yet. So why not make a choice like that if you're the Democrats? Now we see the consequences of it. But it's easy to understand why they did it at the time.
Thomas Frank, thank you very much.
It is my pleasure.
Again, the name of the book, Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's coverage of the Republican National Convention live from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm Askia Muhammad with Mitch Jeserich and Davey D. Outside today, Davey D., there were demonstrations, or perhaps they were more accurately rehearsals for police SWAT tactics. What did you see out there?
Well, for people who don't know what's going on in Cleveland, they have a place that they call Public Square. It's a park. That is maybe about 5 or 6 blocks away from the convention center. But it's very difficult to get through with all the barriers and all that. And there in that park, they've allowed a variety of protesters to just be there simultaneously. So on one side, you'll have people that are calling folks derogatory names if they're gay, calling people derogatory names if they are immigrants or undocumented, et cetera, et cetera. And there will be literally 100 police officers standing there in double lines. So if you want to actually get real close, you have to go through 2 rows of police. And then on the other side of the park, you'll see another set of protesters who have the exact opposite, and it's a battle of the bullhorns. So it's just been one big smorgasbord. So some people have gotten smart and said, we won't go to Public Square. We'll go to the heavily trafficked trafficked areas. And that's what happened this afternoon. People managed to get up to the front of the RNC gate, and they pulled out an American flag and proceeded to burn it. At which point, you saw, literally, I put video up there, hundreds of cops run up from every direction. Trump supporters come out. People who were using derogatory words towards folks while holding up Jesus signs. And it was just one big chaotic scene. People yelling, Nazis go home. People yelling, USA, USA. Police moving everybody and shutting down that that entranceway. And that's what was really going on. It was, in many ways, rehearsal for cops that want to get their scrimmage game on.
They had the horses. They had the bicycles. They had the heavily armed and dressed in.
Yeah, but at the same time, it was something that made for good news coverage, because literally there's a picture with more than 500 news cameras taking pictures of the flag burning. So this is what happened, and here's some sound of what I experienced this afternoon.
Area, so you gotta go that
way.
So there you have a little bit of what's going on. They eventually arrested the people. Many of them were members of the Reb.com collective. And so as they were being hauled off into the paddy wagons, they were yelling, America's never been great. America's never been great.
2, 4, 6, 8. America's never been great.
So, you know, if you're talking about this entire convention being one that is just a theatrical presentation, I think they played into it. And if you wanted to get media coverage, they did a darn good job doing that, just to see all those people that were standing around. And the look on the face was like, I can't believe they burnt the flag. But I was actually interviewing somebody at that time, and he pointed out, he said, you know, here we have in Cleveland people who have been killed with impunity by the police. We have poverty that is right around the corner, and nobody would rush to that sort of with the same enthusiasm to stop those sorts of crimes against people. But burn a flag.
But flag burning is not illegal. The Supreme Court upheld a flag, overturned a flag burning conviction.
Yeah, I wish I could show you the video to see the horses. That was the thing that reminded me of the Edmund Pettus Bridge thing, because you saw the police ride in with horses and separate the crowd, and the fire engines came in there and they stomped out the flag.
And they shouted in unison, go back.
So there was literally about 300 or 400 cops within that small, less than a block area, just to stop the flag burning. So that is what was taking place.
Stopping a legally permitted activity.
One flag. Not even a big flag.
Yeah.
So that's what we're dealing with at the Clown Fest that they call the RNC.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's coverage of the Republican National Convention from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and now joining us at our table is Harmeet Dhillon. Harmeet Dhillon is vice chair of the California Republican Party, also a new official with the RNC. Harmeet Dhillon, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure to be here,
and
Mitch.
And you are supporting Trump.
I am. He's the nominee of our party.
Is that why you're supporting Trump?
Yes. I mean, you know, I expect all the Republican officers in the party to get behind our nominee.
And that seems to be what's happening on the stage. Maybe not all amongst the delegates, but on the stage that seems. I guess we'll still have to see what Ted Cruz says, though.
We'll have to see what Ted Cruz says, but I can tell you that he wouldn't have been invited to come here to speak if his message is not going to be positive.
Yeah, no, you would know that as an official
right.
Now with the party.
The reality is that the presumptive nominee really controls who's invited to speak. So, you know, I spoke on the stage yesterday. I gave the prayer. That wouldn't have happened if I had been, you know, one of the renegade never Trumpers.
And you gave a prayer, a Sikh prayer, was
I did.
It? I saw that on TV.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So that's progress for the party.
It is. You know, they actually had a Sikh prayer 4 years ago in Tampa, but I'd be the first member of the Republican National Committee to deliver a Sikh prayer.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You did not support Trump in the primary?
Well, because I was a party official, our party rules don't allow us to endorse before there's a nominee, so I did not support any one of them, but I publicly stated that I would have supported any of them.
Any of them?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So you don't have concerns about Trump and what's happening with the party? I know you know about the criticisms of Trump.
Well, I would say that there are probably some concerns and question marks I could raise about each of the candidates. I mean, they all have their pros and they all have their cons. But what I have seen in Mr. Trump as a candidate is that he's a businessman who never ran for office before. He has grown in the role of candidate. He's a very strong personality. And I think we're at a crossroads in our country where actually both parties are looking for outsiders and not your traditional corporate or machine politicians. I mean, Hillary Clinton is the nominee presumptive on the Democratic side, but she's not exactly, giving warm and fuzzy feels to a lot of your listeners. So I think that outside, it's the year of the outsider, and Mr. Trump is the consummate outsider.
No, there is not a lot of warm and fuzzy feelings about Hillary Clinton by our listeners, but I think there's a lot of alarm about Donald Trump. I know you know some of what these alarms are about. The things that he has said about banning all Muslims from coming into this country. I mean, there's echoes there of the Chinese Exclusion Act. I mean, some of the really terrible things in our history.
Well, I believe his policy position currently, which I think has been refined over the course of this campaign, is that he wants to temporarily suspend or at least look more carefully at immigration from certain countries that sponsor terrorism. I mean, that's a sound national security thing to do. And by the way, most Muslim countries do that, actually. I mean, if you're a citizen of India, you can't go freely into Pakistan and vice versa. That is a function of history, and I don't think that's crazy. But the rhetoric that has been used sometimes could have been better words, could have been chosen. But again, you're looking at somebody who's never run for office before, and so I give him a little bit of a pass on that. But
how about the deportation of all 11 or so million undocumented immigrants in this country?
Well, again, if this country is not a party of laws, then the country will cease to exist. And so I do believe in enforcing the borders, whether it's with a physical wall or actual enforcement of the existing laws. I think those are important for the economic health of California, frankly. And I'm speaking as an immigrant. I came from India, and I followed the rules, and I employ people in California. And, you know, I think, frankly, big business likes there to be illegal immigration in this country because they can get cheaper labor and they can exploit people. And I don't think that's what we want in our country. We don't want exploitation of a shadow class, but neither do we want open lawlessness. And what we've seen, you know, in San Francisco, where I live, is the sanctuary city policy, which was a humanitarian policy to help refugees escape from Central American civil war, has turned into, you know, a catch and release program for a lot of people who commit crimes in our city. And
it a lot of people who commit crimes? There's a high profile case about it, but how
not
representational
a high profile
is that?
Case. There's a lot of cases of that. There are multiple cases of people around the Bay Area as well as in California who have been released from immigration holds in violation of federal law, and who have then gone on to commit more crimes. I mean, I'm the victim of a crime from an illegal alien who the police were like, well, you know, what do you want us to do, arrest him? And I'm like, yes, I would like you to arrest this person because he committed a crime against me, and he shouldn't get better treatment than native-born criminals just because he happens to be here illegally. So I think that we have a very backward policy in California, and if Mr. Trump did one thing in his first 100 days that he has campaigned on, which would be to stop federal funding subsidies for cities that refuse to comply with federal immigration law, that would be a major accomplishment in my view.
Harmeet Dhillon, we're both from California. We're both from the Bay Area.
Yes, we are.
And you can, you know, feel free to you probably will disagree with me on this statement, but why don't I get your reaction to it? I've been covering Republican politics in the state for the last 15 years. I was a Sacramento State reporter for KPFA in Berkeley. And what I saw, and I think we started to see this, especially after the move for Prop 187, which we would characterize as an anti-immigration bill that a court has mostly called unconstitutional. Since then, I feel like there has been a major backlash against the Republican Party in the state of California, and it has shrunk considerably in the state. And you see it in the representation in the state legislature. You had a Republican governor in Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I think that was an anomaly more than representational of what's happening in the state. I think what we are seeing on the national level with the Republican Party is a very similar dynamic. And almost with Donald Trump is a very perfect example of that. Just becoming a smaller party. Now, you know, in Congress, you have a huge lead in the House of Representatives, but I think that has a lot to do with how you draw the districting lines. But if you look at demographics and a changing country, I kind of think I see what I think has happened to the Republicans in California happening nationally.
Well, Mitch, everything you said about what's happening in California, I think, is accurate. I don't think that the decline of the Republican Party is solely or even primarily due to Prop 187, but it's certainly been a challenge with minority communities, specifically the Latino communities, to get votes from that community. And we've been struggling with that ever since. And, you know, rhetoric that paints with too broad a brush about a community is unhelpful. I will concede that point. However, like you just said, I mean, we have great, you know, majorities in the Congress and both houses. And
maybe, I mean, not for long, though.
We'll see. And, you know, we the White House trades hands fairly regularly between the two parties that have been the traditional top two parties in this country. So I hope you're wrong. But I think what we're seeing in the last 7 years is, you know, really a very divided country. Barack Obama wasn't my candidate, right? But I'm proud as an American to see history made with a candidate. I was like, okay, great. We have some racial issues in this country. We're not going to have him anymore after him. Our racial divide in this country is greater as a result of what we've seen over the last 7 years. I don't think the comments that our president has made about shootings have been helpful. I think he's jumped to conclusions where he's been found wrong, actually, by juries and by grand juries refusing to indict and so forth. And so I think that, you know, he hasn't been a healer. Is Donald Trump going to be a healer? I mean, that remains to be seen, obviously. But I think I'm fairly certain that Hillary Clinton is not going to be a healer. She is continuing the politics of racial divisiveness that are unhelpful. And, you know, I grew up in the Deep South. I didn't grow up in California. And California is a very diverse, welcoming place. I don't really worry about my safety in certain neighborhoods or whatever. But, you know, in rural North Carolina, where I grew up, the Democratic Party was the, you know, the Klan party, the party where they wanted the blacks to live on one side and the whites to live on the other side. And, you know, so, you know, race is a complex issue in this country, and I think we do need to confront some issues still. I think some of the shootings of some of the African-Americans in the last few weeks have been tragic and terrible, and, you know, nobody should lose their life because a trigger-happy white cop is afraid of a black man, et cetera. And so I think that's tragic. Those situations should be prosecuted as such. We cannot treat all the police as guilty because of the mistakes of a few. So, you know, I hope that our next president is able to make progress on healing in our country.
Harmeet Dillon, thank you very much.
My pleasure to be here, Mitch.
Again, Harmeet Dillon is vice chair of the California Republican Party and now also an official with the RNC.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's coverage of the Republican National Convention from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm Askia Muhammad with Mitch Jesuits, Davey D., and the crew. We're joined at the table now by the former chair of the Republican National Committee, the former lieutenant governor of the great state of Maryland. He is Michael Steele, and he's with us. Thank you for being with us.
It's good to be with you. How's it going?
Good, good. Thank you. And I guess in your capacity as chair of the RNC, you oversaw much of your successor after the 2012 election ordered what was called by some an autopsy. On how the party could become a national winner in national elections.
Yeah, you know, the idea of the autopsy, you know, was the RNC's effort to try to get a handle on what happened in the 2012 election, to try to figure out precisely where the party needed to go next. It looked at all kinds of things, from messaging to branding to fundraising, etc. Some of the key elements of that, though, had to do with, you know, how the party fared with minority voters across the country, with a specific focus and emphasis on Hispanics and African Americans.
Whose numbers are increasing as white voters' numbers are declining.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that's the new reality for both parties. Democrats have long been in a space to take advantage of that. Republicans have largely stayed away from that space, making different calculations politically about how they will generate their vote. and more precisely, who their vote is. The reliance on, you know, a white vote of a certain age and a certain location in the country.
It sounds like the Trump campaign.
Well, it's not just the Trump campaign. I mean, it's campaigns across the country that have been pre-designed by the gerrymandering of districts. And all of that. So it's not just, you know, I'm glad you said that in one sense, because a lot of folks are putting stuff on Trump that just doesn't belong on Trump, because these things were elements and problems for the party before he showed up. The party didn't deal with these things. The party is not focused on these things in a way that would make a difference. So by virtue of his outlandish, crazy, out there, you know, sort of approach to the process, a lot of folks just have used him as a dumping ground for a lot of the problems in the party.
But then,
I just want to make it clear that, you know, the relationship the party had with minorities, you know, didn't go south when Donald Trump came in and started talking about Mexicans and Muslims and all of that. May have made it more difficult, given what was in the autopsy report about trying to address some of those concerns. But I think you've got to step back, and I've said this to the party on a number of occasions, you've got to step back and get out of this sort of cycle mentality, you know, where each cycle in the political process, you're looking at it and go, oh, well, this didn't work, we got to try this. You got to step back and look at it holistically, which is what I try to do as chairman, and take a 50-state strategy, bottom up, engaging along the way communities of color, various diversities and interests, so that we can get a better handle on how we move forward into the future.
But what the Trump campaign appears in the minds of many to have done with his strategy of really exploiting the angry white male what he did was to in the minds of some, and I would offer you this as for your comment, to build a wall around the GOP and make the party of Lincoln now a white power party.
Yeah, I don't buy that. No, I think that what you have in large measure is Donald Trump doing what guys like him do, who are in the business of marketing, branding, and building image. Donald Trump is all about getting your attention. Dog whistles, yeah, I'll use them.
It's a bullhorn now.
It may be, but but the point is, that's something that we've not seen in politics before. You know, we come from a political experience where people play it safe. They want, you know, they want their politics clean and neat. Well, guess what? Politics is not clean and neat. There's a whole lot of dirty, ugly stuff that goes on in politics. Here you have a guy that actually stands up on the stage and talks about it publicly. You know, when he gets up there and he goes, you know, there used to be a time that when you started acting up at a rally, they took you out. You know, and everybody in the hall, you know, they're like, well, yeah. So that's not what we've seen before. But get this, on the other side, while it is not in that tone and not spoken in that way, Bernie Sanders did the same thing. He did it on policy. He boxed Hillary Clinton in on policy. You know, he got Hillary Clinton signing up to give us a whole bunch of free stuff that Hillary Clinton is not about to give us, because that's not been what she wanted. But he created the argument, and he drew into that argument a new generation, not in terms of age, but just in terms of coming into the system. Voters who were like, yeah, that's what we want. Finally, someone is talking about progressive ideas in the Democratic Party. On the right, finally someone is talking about, you know, the things that we're angry about. So,
Michael, David D. here.
Hey, David.
You know, I met you in 2004.
Yeah.
If you remember, you was at Jay-Z's club.
Jay-Z's club, yeah. Right? And I thank that brother for letting me use his club for a Republican function at that convention. So.
But what we had was a conversation about culture and talking to people in languages that they understand.
Yeah.
And maybe you can comment on this. It seems like Trump used culture in the form of reality, television,
yeah,
his celebrity. And with that being said, is that now start to become a blueprint for the Republicans, and is this a lesson that others should really learn?
Yeah, no, I think it's a blueprint for a lot of folks. I'm just here to tell you, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, a liberal, a conservative, progressive, or whatever, the next few cycles of politics, you're going to see candidates emerge in this mold that are going to be pushing the envelope in a way that we haven't seen before. Now, they may not go to the same degree as a Donald Trump because their own sense of decency and or whatever and sort of will limit that. But it will not surprise me to have a candidate get up and challenge the system the way he did and make it, in one sense, make a mockery of it. Talking about how rigged it is, talking about, you know, and we saw, again, some of that from
Bernie
Sanders.
But I'm looking more really concretely. Do you start to go and become famous, get on a reality TV show? Do you start to do those types of things? Because that's what I see a lot of people relating to him about because he's a celebrity.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, look, you're already getting certain names out of Hollywood and the music industry talking about running for president. Okay, really, sit down. No, that's... but... at the same time, that is something that, to your point, is now part of this foundation. Now, whether or not it firms up and becomes something that a future candidate will stand on, in other words, let's take a very popular actor, all right?
Like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And before that, Ronald Reagan.
And you had Jesse Ventura.
In Minnesota.
Minnesota, governor
of
Minnesota.
Who passed.
You got Gopher from Love Boat. You do have, this is not unusual in one sense, meaning it's been done before. What I think changes is going forward, now you've sort of widened that platform. And you've given more of these pseudo candidates the opportunity to use celebrity to catapult them into political office with no real foundation. Now, we can admit here, Donald Trump has no foundation,
right?
Now, on policy, I'm not saying anything out of school. I'm not saying nothing that anybody who's followed this campaign for the last year doesn't know already.
I reached out to J.C. Watts. He's not fishing. Who is it? One of the Republican senators said he's going to stay home and mow his lawn, not attend. J.C. Watts, the former House Republican chairman, who is now retired, is in California giving out food, doing God's work. He said senior Republican elected official in the country, Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, is not here.
Yeah.
Who else did I have here on my list?
Do you have the governor of the state's not here.
The governor of this state is not here. But in particular, these black individuals are not here for whatever reasons. I asked someone else, "Are you Team Trump?" He said, "Well, I'm Team Ben Carson." Black people want to in the party or want to be loyal to the party, but then. Donald Trump seems to be anathema to what they joined the party for, because I remember Art Fletcher. I remember Milton Benz and all of the old. These are all the ones I mentioned. Scott and Watts were rock-ribbed conservative Republicans, but not in the mold of Art Fletcher and the Rockefeller Republicans. Yeah. There's no
room. That party hasn't existed in a long time.
The Jack Kemp Republicans.
Hasn't existed in a long time.
But that's the party that blacks who embraced the Republican Party in the 70s and 80s thought they were joining, and now they find themselves in the party of David Duke and Duck Dynasty.
It's not the party of David Duke. It's
well, Duck Dynasty then.
That may be, but it's not the party of David Duke. It's a party that has elements, clearly Tea Party. There have, those who, support a sort of populist perspective, which is what Donald Trump is kind of representing in many respects.
Duck Dynasty says, "I'm from Louisiana and I'm a redneck."
Well, yeah, and they played some redneck music, but they also played some rock and roll. I don't know what the ultimate point.
Do you feel safe in that environment?
Yeah, why wouldn't I?
It just seems very scary because...
Rocket, what?
No, I mean, when you have the type of vitriol that seems to be placed upon people who are of different persuasions, where people are looking at you suspiciously, and you could see that anger and that demonization suddenly become a profiling type of situation that does often lead to people feeling very unsafe. I felt unsafe the other night when I saw everybody yelling USA, USA, and kind of giving you that look. That's how I honestly felt, and I came inside.
I can appreciate that. I didn't feel unsafe, so I don't know.
Is it because they know Michael Steele? Do you think if Michael Steele was unknown that you would feel comfortable?
No, I mean, they didn't know me when I joined the party. They didn't know me, you know,
but they
before
weren't doing
I became
all that
lieutenant
then.
Governor. Yeah, they were. I mean, look.
Tim Scott's a U.S. senator. He said since he's been elected, in 1 year, he was stopped seven times.
By
police.
So what's that got to do with the Republican Party?
Well, and it has a lot to do with being racially profiled and not feeling safe.
What's that got to do with the Republican Party?
Well, Blue Lives Matter is the Republican Party theme, and
But that's not what Tim Scott said.
No, he said he felt he had been profiled and felt uncomfortable.
And again,
as a black man,
what does that have to do with the Republican Party? Tim Scott is the Republican senator from South Carolina.
The most prominent and highest elected black Republican in the country.
Absolutely. And again, what does that have to do with the Republican Party? He was not stopped by the Republican Party. He was not pulled over by the Republican Party. So what does that have to do with the Republican Party?
Him being a Republican senator in his home state, being a prominent elected official, bought him nothing in the eyes of police.
That's because the police didn't know who he was.
They saw he was a black guy and said, that's all I need to know.
And again, I asked, what does that have to do with the Republican Party? And my point by making that point is you're conflating something that is wholly doesn't exist. Tim Scott was talking about his encounter with police, an anonymous encounter with police who do not know who he is, and all they see is a black man. They don't know his party affiliation. They don't know where he lives. All they see is a black man. That's the point he was making. When my son was pulled over a few weeks ago, he's an independent. What's that got to do with the independent party? Nothing. He got pulled over because he's a young black man driving a car at 1 o'clock in the morning. This is the problem. You cannot have a discussion honestly about these issues if you start conflating and moving politics in a way to score or make a political point. That has nothing to do, absolutely nothing to